This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to the June edition of Book Lovers Corner. I'm Gareth Raps and I'm with Steve Lawrence, owner of Elmo's Bookshop. Actually, Steve, I just had to say, I was auto-corrected to almost.
Okay, I didn't have not struck that before, but yeah.
So I thought, actually, that's a great name for a bookshop.
Almost a bookshop. No, I'd like to think we're...
a bit more than that?
Yeah, I think we're the real deal.
Anyway, we're coming to you from the Wairarapa Community Access Radio Station, Arrow FM 927. You can find us on other platforms like Elmo's Bookshop's Facebook page, YouTube, and the Wairarapa TV Freeview Channel 41. We're the program that looks at books once a month, and... we always start with Steve telling us a little bit about Elmo's and why Word.
Yep.
So let's hit with that.
Okay. Well, the big event at the bookshop this month is we went, since the 2nd of June, we've now become Elmo's Books and Cafe, because the cafe, which was located in our building at 42 High Street South, called Page 42, stopped trading for... shade over a month, but we have got ourselves a new operator, Diane Wilkins, and her son Jason. And
I met Jason. He's good. And the coffee was good.
Yeah, they're both very good.
They seem to like they've reshaped the cafe a bit.
Yeah, we changed things around a little bit just to integrate it more with the bookshop. So just it. No carpenters involved, just moved a few shelves, nothing's nailed down, and just moved one or two other bits and pieces around, so it kind of flows a bit better.
That's good, it's a good vibe. I enjoy the cafe and enjoy the Elmo's,
I should also say, at the moment, for another shade over 2 weeks, we've got an exhibition of photographs on the wall done by Madeline Slavik. Madeline works for us 3 mornings a week, and photographs from her time in Hong Kong, where she lived for many years, and I think they look really cool on the walls. They are for sale because Madeline's trying to raise some money to help the poor benighted citizens of Hong Kong who aren't getting quite as free a ride as they used to have. So
you're getting no ride. And if you come in when Madeline's working, which is...
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday mornings.
Then you get the backstory behind the photos and not just the photos to look at. So we'll purchase. Okay, sounds good.
So that's a good thing. So that's what's happening at Elmo's.
You've had, since we met, another Why Word Sunday event?
It was. Why Word's kind of going now. So we've had two events. The last one was 2 Sundays ago, and traditionally we're the first Sunday of the month, but it's not been possible to coordinate any damn thing this year. So we had Gillian Sullivan come along from the Maniototo, or the Ida Valley, deepest, darkest central Otago. And the reason that we did something in the middle of the month is her mum lives in Masterton, and she was coming up around then anyway. So we try and work in with people to minimise our transport costs. Now, Gillian is famous for a number of things. She's written a lot of books, actually.
I saw a new one.
Yeah. The new one is...
sort of stark.
Yeah.
Cover. Oh, you've got it.
This one here. Map for the Heart, which is essays based around...
That's kind of like a Graham Sidney landscape, big sky, Chicago. That's...
Well, she's Brian Turner, not Brian Turner. Brian Turner's partner. He's one of the Turner brothers, hockey playing, cricket playing,
right. He's
everything.
He's the poet one, isn't he?
He's the poet. Yeah. And he did actually produce a lovely book with poetry, landscapes and photographs with Graham Sidney, called Landmarks, I think.
Yep, great book.
Yeah, very, very handsome. So you're right, that does, could be from there, I haven't checked that. So she came along and talked about writing and she talked about building straw bale houses because her previous book was about the construction of her straw bale house, which she kind of just did.
I can remember, as a youngster going to Naseby and living in a, it seemed like, I think I got a feeling it had a lot of straw in it, but it was a clay type of building.
Well, they chucked the clay on the outside, I think.
Yeah, no, and I've actually lived one when I was a little guy.
Yeah.
Well, holidayed in one down at, you know, in Naseby, and cold as. Like, you know.
Pretty warm inside.
It might be warm inside. Maybe it's just when I was, I just remember my toes.
Cold outside.
And fingers. Never really recovering, you know.
Cold outside down there.
I think it was more Naseby, yeah.
Yeah. But it was a good afternoon, well attended. And someone from your bridge club came along?
Book club.
Book club, oh, okay.
Book club, and really loved it and spoke very positively about it and about her.
Mm.
And she had a lot to say, I understand.
Mm. Yeah, she was very engaging, and she's very focused on the Central Otago rivers and the fact that they there's so much water taken out of them for agriculture now that they flow happily along until they kind of just die.
I watched that This Is the Week with John Oliver you know, on a Netflix program, and his theme was water and basically the Wild West just in America is just fading. There's not enough water. All the rivers are drying up, the aquifers are getting drained, and it's absolutely crisis time.
Mm, it's terrifying.
Yeah, and
one of the points that Gillian made, which is quite interesting, is that the water rights that are used for taking water from the, can't remember the name of the stream, were actually originally for sluicing for gold. So although there's a fair bit of tension down there about, you know, who gets the water, it's not all the farmers who get the water, because unless they have a property which had a water right which had been there since 1860 for looking for gold, they haven't got any water either. So it's
it was the American experience too, that it was like first in had the best dibs, and that the Colorado was divided up between seven states and all that. But you know, the real argument was that the indigenous, you know, the Native Americans, who were the original people, had no rights.
That's right.
And so they got shut out. and they also overestimated the amount of water they had that they were distributing. And, yeah, no, it's like that is, it's totally in the amount of wastage, you know, people growing crops just because they have to use all their water allocation.
Mm.
They can't sort of pass it on to somebody else. So use it or lose it. A lot of strange water issues.
Big topic everywhere. I mean, remember when we were living in Victoria, the Murray River, which is, you know, one of Australia's more significant waterways.
Well, the creek. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't flow to the sea anymore.
It didn't make it.
No, it didn't make it. So that's
A modern contemporary topic that often you don't think would actually affect New Zealand in quite the way it's affecting, but she said we do have our issues.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Is that the government's five rivers?
No, I don't think
they're not looking at
that. No, they're not looking at that.
That's something else. Okay, we'll keep.
Let's not talk about that.
No.
Okay.
And your next one?
Next time, which will be, this will be a complete departure for us, because we've always done Sunday afternoons. Thursday, the 4th of August, at 10 a.m, we're getting Mary Holm to come along to the Carterton Event Centre and talk about money. She's, for people who don't know, one of New Zealand's leading financial journalists. She writes for The Herald. And she has written a number of books.
A while now, hasn't she?
She's been doing this for a long time, yeah.
As far as financial advice goes, kind of she's right in the top echelon of two or three people in New Zealand who got a lot of street cred about.
Yeah, Martin Hawes, I guess.
He'd be another one.
Yeah. I mean, she's going to say, you know, we don't give anybody financial advice, because if you give people advice, you're responsible for what they do.
Oh.
But you can, you know, you can make general comments.
No, I've looked at her previous books. And I'm thinking back many years now. These books have been trickling out. All of them clear, logical, sensible. Be interesting to see whether she matches her sort of lucid books with public speaking and can actually talk about it.
Well, we'll find out. But I think she does. She's done a lot of these presentations. So it's 10 o'clock in the morning. That fits around when she's coming to Wellington, so we're latching onto that.
Yep.
And then she's, in order to make everything work, she's coming over to stay with some friends of hers in Martinborough the night before, and then she's going to catch a train mid-afternoon back to Wellington. So
I can see in our July meeting that we can, when you report back, we'll feed in, because I've just read that Max Rashbrook's book, Too Much Money, which is a terrific, interesting topical read. So let's earmark that for a discussion on the big money picture.
Yeah, well, that our July chat here will in fact predate the early August event. So because of one thing or another, we're not actually having a July event. So but we can talk about Max Rashbrook.
Max can set us up.
Yeah, he can. He will.
He'll do that really well.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Why Word. The other thing I should probably mention is Booktown, two weeks ago now.
How did that go?
Well, it went really, really well, and I'm sure that that Mary and Peter Biggs and their army of helpers down there would be thrilled to bits.
I saw the big ad.
Yeah.
Everybody's name. It seemed to be a vast number of people.
Yeah, it's really changed Booktown from where it started. It's now, I said to someone, it's probably Wellington's leading kind of literary event. And they said, well, it might be New Zealand's. I guess it doesn't really stack up against the Auckland Writers Week, but there's a lot of people.
Well, it's very Kiwi.
Yeah.
Writers Week is kind of, it's like, who are the stars from overseas? But this is our.
Yeah, there are
voices.
Yeah. There is no one from overseas, but luminaries, if you like. Whittier Himara was probably the headliner. He was at several events.
I heard
Anna Kidman.
I heard that she was terrific. I heard and she talked about widowhood, I think, and her latest book.
Yeah.
And Grand.
Yeah, Noel McCarthy.
Noel.
Noel.
Noel. One of us will read that one day.
Yeah, well, if I could get hold of a copy. I mean, we haven't had any stock for ages.
Yeah, no, I can't get hold of it either. It is the hottest book in the
Yeah, list. And it would have sold thousands more if there'd been any. Right. So these are just the little things that we continue to grapple with.
I had feedback on some of the sessions, and there were no real duds. Everybody was very up about the whole event.
Yeah, and very well attended, mostly pre-sold, I think.
How did the big fish and chip? Did you get to that?
Or? I didn't go to that because that's Friday night. We have to get down to Featherstone, get set up for 9 o'clock on the Saturday morning, which means we have to get up in the dark, and I don't like that.
and how did your stand, the Elmo stand, go?
Oh, well, very well.
Because there's a token, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's kind of what our contribution to the thing has been, I think, without any coordination with anybody, that they give, I think, about 500 school kids in South Wairarapa, which includes the years 9 and 10, I think, at Kurunui, $3 $5 book vouchers to redeem at or around the event. And so one of the main things we do is take down some books that kids can get for their $15 rather than have to.
And they were redeemed?
I think we generally redeem the most because we have the most kids' books. And this year we did, I think, 50% more than we did last year. So
terrific, yeah.
Yeah, so it's good.
It's kind of like watch the space because it just doesn't seem to stop getting better.
No, that's right.
And it's the biggest event of Featherstone, it's got this, the national tom-toms are saying this is something special.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, good on that. Okay, hey, moving on. Let us have a quick revisit and allow me to give you back your copy of Freezing Order, which Bill Browder, which we touched on last week. And I hadn't read it, so now I have.
Yes.
What a great story of murder and mayhem and money laundering.
And general naughtiness.
Yeah. It takes us into a world that the average citizen of the world doesn't really deal with, which is lawsuits and law cases and courts dealing with, you know, technical money issues. And he gets us right into the thick of it. And
actually, not all of the lawyers come out of that looking very sort of honourable,
like,
do they?
Chicanery.
Yeah.
Just a whole, you know, employing gunslingers, you know, and the fact that the Russians are sort of beamed into the courtroom and can sit there and are wired up to their lawyer to, you know, offer tactical assistance.
Who was the lawyer that attended the infamous meeting in Trump Tower with
I know. It's a morality tale. You know, one man versus Putin and, you know, the world's most dangerous killer on one level, you know, and a dictator and self-promoter. And Bill really is rolled up his sleeves. And it is a tremendous example of acknowledging a great friendship that was taken away from him, you know, but with the murder of his friend.
Yes.
And saying, actually,
I'm going to do something about that.
Yeah. And most people would fade.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you take a state and a dictator on? And Bill's tale is just,
Knowing that dictator has access to KGB operatives with Novichok that they,
I know. I like Red Notice better.
Yes.
But I did enjoy this one, and the highs and lows.
Red Notice was a bit more exciting. This is a lot of it spent in courtrooms.
I kind of get
fundamentally that. Tedious places.
He's a good writer, though.
Yeah.
He can make that stuff work. And you do get a little, you know, kind of tense thinking, how's this going to play out? Because you don't kind of know often the results from it. But he good triumphs over evil in the end. So, I mean, who doesn't like that? But as I said before, it's an insight into a strange other world.
It's interesting, you know, just so people may not know, Red Notice is the notice that Interpol put out saying that people can be, you know, any subject state, any one member of Interpol should pick this person up. And that freezing order starts with them getting arrested in Spain.
Right, in Barcelona and getting taken to some obscure police station.
Yeah.
I know, straight away you get the feeling of, you know, we're into a good tale here. I mean, that's straight out of a thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, because he was,
But the freezing order is that's an order under the Magnitsky Act, which enables people to freeze assets. And that's the reason that Vladimir Putin doesn't like him, because old Vlad's got $1 trillion stashed away somewhere, and it's not in Russia.
I know, and he points out it's going to touch through New York. Moving on.
Yep.
What have you got over there, Steve? Just as another, your next book.
Okay, well, in terms of what I've been reading, this is a book called The Sleeping and the Dead, which is written by Anne Cleves, who's Elmo's favourite crime writer. Now, she's selling in large numbers for her Vera series, which has been on the telly, and Shetland series, which has also been on the telly. This book is one of her very first novels, which, as she points out at the front, was originally published in 2001, and hardly anybody read it.
And that's her first?
I
mean, often that's where all the graft and hard work and discovering how good you are is all going to be in the first book.
Yeah, well, she was good enough to get it published, but not sufficiently good to get people to buy it. But it's interesting, if you've read the Shetland series and the Vera series, they are very character-driven by the police women and men involved. You know, if you've watched Brenda Blethard on the telly being very, you can see that she's, that they've got very quirky personalities, her policemen. This is not like that. This is, I suppose in some ways it's a bit more traditional. The story is, it starts with, we were talking about rivers drying up. This was about a lake drying up and reaching a level that hadn't been reached for 30 years, at which point someone comes across a body which has been weighted to the bottom of the lake with an anchor, which clearly doesn't look like natural causes.
Those anchors are giveaways, yep.
Yeah. So that's what this is about, and it's solving a mystery 30 years on.
Classic cold case.
Yeah, because this particular body turns out to be a young man who was reported missing, but not until 2 years after anybody had last seen him. So the people involved at the time never mentioned the fact that he wasn't there anymore. So it's...
which is why. You can't tell me that because that's
Too
much of a spoiler. But
I can't tell you anymore. But it's... yeah, so the central character in this is actually his high school girlfriend, because they were still at school.
So this is a re-release.
It's a re-release.
Of a freshly minted...
Yeah.
Like, and you'd give it a huge heads up.
Oh, yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah.
Interesting. She has an interesting, quite a sort of a workaday writing style. She's not, there's not a lot of adjectives in this book. It's about stuff happening and things happening to people and how people react to the things that happen to them. There's not, as I say, it's not much in the way of florid descriptions. But that's kind of what you expect from police work, I think so.
So if you love, you know, Jimmy Perez and the Shetland's Tales, this is a good go back and read a standalone.
Yeah.
Standalone, excellent book.
Mm.
Okay.
Very cool.
Very good. Okay, my next one. I've got a serious one here for us. On Consolation, Finding Solace in Dark Times by Michael Ignatieff. Now, I've run across...
You know that's how you pronounce his name?
No, I'm just making it up. I'm faking it. I go Ignatieff.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Ignatieff. I think that's... If we break it down into syllables, I've got it. Michael. We'll call him Michael. I'd read something...
I bet either the G or the E N is silent, but...
Oh, now you've got me. But On Consolation, Finding Solace in Dark Times. Now, the... We'll call him Michael. he's an academic and who's sort of broken out into the greater world of publishing and has published many books, not many which are available, it feels like, in New Zealand, but On Consolation has found its way to us. And he had his background as a politician in Canada, and he was the head of the Liberal Party there for a while and has written a book about those experiences and in other academic books. And then he's now a professor in Vienna, and he's come up with this book, which is How Do You Console Each Other in the Age of Unbelief is kind of like the underlying theme of this. Now, a series of portraits of writers, artists, musicians, who searched for consolation. Now, we all engage with consolation. We have, if we're human, inevitably going to lose parents.
Dogs and cats.
Yeah, we get to an age where, and people lose their children, people lose their partners, and how they find consolation for this over time, the various ways. And so... Michael has looked at how across the last hundreds of years, how people have tried to find hope and resilience in the traditions of consolation. And he starts off sort of looking at how the Bible provided, the Book of Jacob and the Book of Psalms were classic, sort of people reached into that. And then you got that Stoicism. Cicero wrote, his daughter died, and he wrote a letter which many people have could have found solace in that. And then you had Marcus Aurelius up in the battlefields fighting the barbarians, writing his notes to himself in Meditations, which became one of the great classic books. But then it moves on and you get an El Greco painting that was significant, Michel Montaigne with his great essays absolutely looked at how he found consolation. He had lost his great friend and wrote about that in the very first way where someone let their innermost thoughts, sort of invented the idea of the essay. Then you had Karl Marx, who sort of looked at how he found consolation in revolution, change. Abraham Lincoln witnessing, or the sort of the Civil War and how you had to console a nation, the idea of that. Gustav Mahler, the sort of great symphonies, which were secular steps out of trying to find music that would console us. People who had witnessed terrible things, like in the death camps, Primo Levi, and people in Russia, and terrible moments where people had witnessed things and how they consoled. And then you had Albert Camus with his the book The Plague, about how we console each other in the times of COVID and the pandemic. And also The Good Death, the story of Cicely Saunders, who created hospices, and which was a new way now we have of, over the last 50, 60 years, of looking at this death. I noticed great balance of literary people and personal reflections. Terrific stylist. I mean, he's absolutely one of those academics which is fun to read. He's not difficult at all. Sharp, dignified, thoughtful. We just trying to sum it up. It's kind of like, how do you get rid of the self-pity issue is kind of tucked away in there. Failures in our life and tragedies in our life are great teachers. We learn about this as we go along and lose those around us. But his idea is, it's like, in the end, it's not all these great ideas and philosophies and all that which console us. It's very much a solidarity with humanity. People have been through this before, and it is the people. We belong, you know, to each other. Consolation is kind of like a gift. It's a sort of moment of grace. Sometimes we don't deserve it, but it somehow finds that it may be really fleeting, but it does remind us that actually life is worth living, even though sometimes it's absolutely not dealing us the best cards. Terrifically engaging book, you know, in little short kind of essays, and I haven't mentioned all of them, but I recommend it. It's kind of like a good, meaty book.
So is it something that people would reach for at the time that they needed some solace? Or is it something that you would just have on the shelf and read so you got yourself kind of organized for
part of it is
when your dog's getting a bit older?
Exactly. good question. I remember books like Julian Barnes' Sense of a Belonging, things like that, look at that, you know, have engaged beautifully with looking at mortality. It's in that, it's kind of like just our own education of ourselves, and it points at places that we may find consolation in music or in art or in some great works. The epilogue in itself, just those few pages, that's something I would return to if it was in my bookshelf. But it's more like saying, actually, no, it's going to be the people around you that are actually going to work for you, and it's how you reach and react to them is all going to how it's going to go. Book to make you think. Okay, now let's moving on. We'll have another, just before we have a music break, a quick one for us.
I brought this along just because it's new. This is a book called Horse by Geraldine Brooks. Now, she's an Australian who lives mostly in America. This book is set in America. It appears as though it might be about horse racing, and it probably is to an extent, but it's really about racism and slavery over the 170-odd years that are spanned by the what goes in this book.
I read one like the Secret Cord.
Yes, so that was her previous book, which was about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah. And that was excellent.
Yeah.
Good book.
So that's about David. And
right, yeah, that's a sort of like a biblical sort of, but it's bigger than that. It had bigger issues and all that.
Yeah.
Nice style. And I've seen reviews on it. It just seems such a strange topic.
Well, it's a strange way of carrying the topic, I guess. I mean, the previous book to The Secret Cord is Caleb's Crossing, which was about the first Native American man to graduate from Harvard, which turns out to be in about 1560 or something. So it was, and that's about, finding your place and,
right.
Between cultures and, so, big themes in these books, but very readable.
Well reviewed. She has a following, so it's certainly one to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, so I have great hopes for Horse.
It looks kind of equine on the, and it's kind of like, will people see it as a novel, or will they go, actually, it's something to do with people who live in Karaka who go to horse shows, sort of.
Well, I think they'll see it as a novel, but they might need a little bit of explaining that it's not like,
And that's where you and your staff come in.
Exactly.
That's what you do.
Yes, that's what
we do. Let's move to some music. What I've got here now, we're working our way through the CD, I Want to Be a Blues Man, which is a sort of collection of great blues artists. And our song today is actually called Home Cooking by King Curtis. Now, King Curtis is one of the... Back in the blues day, was one of the great saxophone players, and this one's called Home Cooking. Just as an aside, home cooking is a sort of expression that comes out of sport also, where if you are playing away...
Also comes out of the drug trade, doesn't it?
I've always seen it as a sports thing, and if the referees are favouring the hometown, you say... Well, I'm thinking I'm seeing a little bit of home cooking here. And it's kind of like, we're getting the raw end of the calls. But anyway, King Curtis and Home Cooking.
Thank you.
and it's welcome back to Book Lovers Corner. Thought we'd start the second half by looking on at actually a little bit what's happening down at Greytown Library. They got into this Matariki thing quite, and they had a sort of star dome that you could come and sort of look at it and all that. But, and I noticed they had displays of books and all that. How did that play, Matariki play out at Elmo's?
Well, it plays well, particularly for kids' books. There are quite a lot of kids' books written about Matariki as a way to, I guess, get kids familiar with what it's about and what they ought to be doing. And there are some more serious books as well. I'm desperately trying to remember the name of the book published by Huia, which is a piece of serious Maori astronomy, if you like, by someone, an academic from Hamilton University, which we've sold well for years and sold out again this year. I should have had a lot more. And Huia have sold out as well. Mm. I tried to get some more. So clearly there's a lot of interest.
There were several books in the library, a children's books, which makes me think there's a, you know, those books will get their yearly exposure, and they're pretty good. So, you know, the Greytown Library, I mean, they were sort of getting into the Festival of Christmas, which kicks off this week, and there's lots happening in these libraries, and we'll try and pick up in future times what's just, you know, happening around the traps on the library scene. But let's bring us up to our next book. I've got another Kiwi book here. Now, David Burt, Embedded. I'm holding a pristine copy here from Elmo's. A little bit, give us a story about David. I mean, how's that gone?
It's done okay. It's his first novel. Again, it's anybody would tell you it's hard to get published. So the fact that he managed to do that says that the editors at who's published that? I can't remember. Might be Bateman's, is it?
It is published by Mary Egan.
Oh, Mary Egan, yeah.
2022.
Distributed by David Bateman, yeah. So Mary, she publishes some New Zealand fiction. But she won't publish things that she doesn't believe in.
Yeah. Hey, look, a New Zealand into sort of national thriller. This is a little unusual. There are not a lot of these around. We have our own crime writers and police procedurals and detectives and those sort of tales. But an international one, a sort of, you know, take on it, is a bit of a first. I did have a little bit of a look at David Burt. He's an electrical contractor, you know, a big one with, you know, staff of 100 plus and all that, and he has a sort of MBA and from Massey. But he's a self-confessed, his passion is writing, and here it is, his first book, Embedded. It takes us back into 1982, Afghanistan, a botched CIA operation takes out a family, and a young man is on a path for revenge and retribution. And it's a long quest. And we're on the sort of adventure of, starts in Afghanistan. Then it, as a young man, washes up after sort of dealing in the drug scene, in Pakistan, washes up into New Zealand, as a refugee, or sort of as he tries to escape. And then we get his a little bit of, making it in New Zealand and in the contracting world, you know, the building world, but gets a great idea for an international terrorist act by involving in our housing problems in New Zealand of building big buildings. So he targets big buildings and gets the knowledge and takes a workmate from him to New York, where the next the major part of the book. Short chapters, excellent pace. Ali, our protagonist, is resourceful.
So is he a bad guy?
He's a great, he's a good guy doing bad things.
Right.
Right. So he's resourceful and we never give too many spoilers away here.
No.
So we've got a conflicted character here who's perhaps on a dark road, but we're admiring the man and also the better side of him. It stands up well in a well-established genre, you know, that I think, which is a lot of books.
Yeah.
And a Kiwi take, well-written, well-paced, and I think it's better than most. And if you're a fan of, like, the Jason Bourne, Jack Reachery sort of guy, but now your hero is Ali, a sort of a New Zealand product, out for vengeance, give it a shot.
Mm.
Okay.
Because it's interesting, you mentioned a comparison with I Am Pilgrim when we were chatting before. And I just got an email today from the Random House rep to say that finally.
Not finally.
Because Terry Hayes, who wrote I Am Pilgrim, we saw the first chapter of the sequel or the next book in about 2012, and I confidently ordered lots, and it's never turned up. But apparently, I think in about September.
He must have run out of money.
No, I didn't run out of money.
That book made him squillions.
Yeah.
And maybe I thought, he just didn't need to. But the fact he'd written a chapter always indicated that he had started. Hey, that can't wait.
Yeah. So, well, we'll.
I mean, Iron Pilgrim is a classic.
Yeah.
Has he written two classics?
Ah, well, sometimes they don't.
What's the place? Yeah. Now, what else you got over there for us?
Well, I've got a couple of sort of Wellington books. These are. We have here a little book on Wellington architecture, which sells really well. And I think you said it's been on Unity's kind of best-selling list forever. And it's just a little book that I lived in Wellington for years, and there's just a couple of pages, one page and a photograph of dozens and dozens and dozens of Wellington buildings, most of which I've seen but never seen, You walk past them and you didn't. It kind of made no impact.
Wallpaper, obviously.
Yeah. So this is about those and who built them and what's interesting and who the architect. It is about architecture, so it talks about architecture.
And it's designed for the pocket. But
it's designed for the pocket.
Yeah, it's not for architectural students, is it? Or
no. Well, it might be.
It could be.
I'll tell you a little bit. But now, buildings like Anvil House, which are, you know where that is?
I do, but I don't know why it was ever called Anvil House or
this will tell
whoever built it.
But this is, he uses an architecturally type thing there. It talks about, I don't know if anybody can see that, but that's the fenestration, the sort of the neat and geometrical way of the fenestration. Now, my new favourite word is defenestration, which means chucking people out of windows. Yeah. So this is about the windows.
And I understand it's like five walking tours.
Are they themed up
or are they just location-wise?
You could do that, I reckon. It's just vaguely interesting to have on your bookshelf or if you're Wellingtonian.
It seems like a book to have in your big pocket.
Or
your knapsack as you
wander around town. Yeah.
And you could interesting book. I mean, we're always curious about the places we live.
Yeah.
And I think there's a market for these. This is a bit more substantial than your, and a bit more focused.
Because one of the things, when you do walk around Wellington, you're mostly on the footpath looking at shop windows. Under the veranda, you don't really see the buildings.
No, not at all.
You do something, but...
And the photography?
Well, just pictures of buildings. I mean, it's all right. It's a picture of a building.
And the text is, the design?
Yeah, and it's just a page. On the Hunter...
So you get a page per building, basically?
Page per building. Page on the Hunter building, which clearly doesn't tell the whole history of the thing, but...
But enough that you can become more knowledgeable. And let's face it, if you live in a place long enough, you're going to find stuff that you can probably annoy everybody else once you know a few facts.
Well, that's right. You'll be able to,
The
bits from the Victor book for boys, the handy facts that I used to share with my sisters when I was younger.
Right.
They loved it. Now, the other book I've brought along
Well, actually, before that, we'll cut into with another thriller, and we'll save the story of the grant for a few
minutes. I want to talk about this because I want to talk about Wellington. You see, this is my little
this
Wellington.
Is linked. Okay, all right. No, take it away.
Only linked in the sense that Mrs. Jewell and the wreck of the General Grant by Christina Sanders is Christina's second work of historical fiction. The first one was called Jerningham, and I lived in Wellington for years and years and years, and it was Point Jerningham, and I never knew why it was called that. But that's Edward Jerningham Wakefield, who was one of the ratbags who was involved with the New Zealand Company, and that's just the most...
So he got a point named after him?
Yes, he did. After his second name, because I suppose Edward and Wakefield, that was...
They've been used.
Jerningham was the point of difference for him. Yeah.
And it's, once again, it's just like, used it all my life, never really...
Never gave it a second thought. Yeah.
Thought it must have been... Well, if you think it's like, those names often came from the founding fathers or back in the day. You just think it's back in the day, but there's no real story.
No. Oh. But they... Yeah, but that Jerningham is a great story about early colonial Wellington. And this is her second book. I think we know about the General Grant and the gold.
Gold, searching for treasure. It's a bit of a classic tale. Who's got the rights?
It's Law of the Sea and Selvage and all that sort of stuff, I imagine.
But it seems like it's contestable these days. Everything's contestable. Everything's lands up in court. So the original owners don't...
I don't know.
Have a claim or...
Most of them died in the shipwreck.
Reaching out from give us a pitch.
But I like this because she's a really good writer. And I think I said that with Anne Cleves there aren't many adjectives. Well, there are quite a lot of adjectives in this. This is much more, I guess... literary, if you like, but it's still a good story and races along. I think I said it to you, it's sort of like the luminaries with shorter sentences. Makes it a lot easier to read.
let's keep away from the comparisons with the luminaries because that can bring, you know, feelings of angst and, you know, a black cloud over my head. So
But early New Zealand and gold and stuff like that.
Well researched. I mean,
she's good that, you know, the history's accurate.
And the market?
Well, anybody likes historical fiction. Anybody who's interested in New Zealand history.
Fiction? You mean non-fiction?
No, this is fiction.
Oh, this is a tale.
This is fiction. Jerningham was a novel. Yeah.
Oh no. I had the wrong steer on. I thought we were back in the.
No, no.
This is the facts, but this is an imagined.
Mrs. Jewell and the Wreck of the General Grant is a vivid imagining of the story behind the enduring mystery of one of New Zealand's early shipwrecks by the author of the best-selling Jerningham. It's 1866 and the three-masted sailing ship General Grant is on the southern route from Melbourne to London with gold from the diggings secreted in the returning miners' hems and pockets. In the fog and the dark, the ship strikes the cliffs of the Auckland Islands, is sucked into a cave and wrecked. Only 14 men make it ashore, and one woman, Mrs. Jewell. So that's
there
what
we go.
Yeah, it's got everything,
and
including a purple cover.
And the wreck has it. I keep seeing it pops up in the news every
now. People, still wanting to go down and find the gold.
It's like somebody is onto it, but
I know where it is.
Getting it out, is it like too deep or?
Not absolutely sure about that.
All right, we'll watch the space.
Mm. But the gold and the General Grant, that's one of New Zealand's.
It's a classic.
Mm. So that's early Wellington.
Early Wellington. Let's leave early Wellington and plunge into Spain. Even the darkest night. Now, if I was doing my, you know, mid-year best books of the year, it would be on my list.
Okay.
It's that good. The... Javier Cercas, C-A-C-E-R-C-A-S.
So he's Spanish.
Circass.
I don't know. One of those C's is going to be silent, isn't it? Or soft.
Circass.
But they probably aren't both. So it's got to be circus or cursus or cursus or Kirkus or something.
I'm sure people actually tune into the show so they can see us mangle the names of authors from overseas.
Well, I only pick people with anglicised.
Right. Anyway, hey, here it is. What we've got is Even the Darkest Night novel, really nice modern Barcelona, Catalan sort of setting to it all.
I know about that. It's Catalonian.
Catalonian. Very satisfying book. It's like, this is a good book. And I was trying to think, why am I rating this so high? I was asking, debating with myself. And I go, actually, it's like a good meal, isn't it? It's kind of like it's got the great ingredients. It's been, well put together. And it, as you're reading it, you're just enjoying it on all sorts of levels. A contemporary police procedural with a literary twist. And maybe that's why it sort of got me going. And the setup is, in the immediate start of the book, we found three people dead in a big, big mansion-type house out of Barcelona, several hours out, in the town of Terra Alta, which is historically one of the great battle sites and of the Civil War.
Okay.
And that's what it was known for. But in fact, it's kind of a sleepy, I'm thinking Palmerston North, quiet sort of little, it's a sort of town, a city, but it's not huge, but it is, and it's kind of away from the big things of Spain. Melchor Marin, our protagonist, is the duty officer, and he's called into this horrific crime where this elderly couple have been killed and also horrifically tortured, which is like, what? And these...
And then couple, why?
And why? And the maid is also dead in another part of the house. It's a house that has maids and cooks. The cook has done a meal and for a lot of people and then left, and the maid is a sleeping maid, and anyway, she is also not tortured, but has been murdered. And our man, who's the policeman, our police guy, Melchor, arrives at it. Now, it turns out the man is the richest man in the region and is absolutely has a big sort of graphic design printing company in the town and in other cities in Spain, and also an office in Mexico. And sort of like as an international, that's a huge thing, employing a lot of people. And this guy has a lot of enemies, as sort of sometimes successful people, accrue as they sort of go through life. And we then start flashing back why Melchor Marin has been there, and we go back to Barcelona of him growing up. His mother is a prostitute, and he is living the hard life in the hard suburbs of a young kid in Barcelona, getting involved with drugs. He's a sort of driver for a sort of cartel in Barcelona, and ends up in juvenile court and ends up doing some time as a teenager. And in there, he is introduced to he's pretty well not educated at all, but he's introduced to Les Miserables, Victor Hugo.
Yes.
The great classic. And this is a revelation to him. And his mother is murdered mysteriously, just like as sometimes happens, and by, in her lifestyle and the way she lives. And he decides that he would like to solve that crime if he could by becoming a policeman. So then he reinvents himself and gets into the training of it. And through things that will happen, he becomes the center of a media storm as a policeman, and is sent to Terra Alta, this backwater town, to sort of
get him out of the way.
Get him out of, and then he's now he's involved in this big crime. That's the setup.
Mm.
Fantastically, beautifully written, of just the tale, and it's a great sort of mystery to be solved. It's literary. It's got references to other books that are influencing his thinking. He's really interested in Javert, the police inspector in the book, Les Miserables, and away it goes.
You followed me across the years, isn't it? This isn't the song. Yeah.
That's right. And he rereads it, and he's constantly growing with the book as he ages. He's learning more and more and more. And it's a great plot. Yeah. Hard worn wisdom that comes from police work. And Javert, the writer, he's a columnist for the Paris, El Paris, Paris newspaper, won lots of prizes. He's huge in Europe, showered with literary awards, 30 languages, the translations. Mm. Terrific book. Recommend it. But we are getting near the end, so a quick wrap on. Oh, you've got a question?
Not really. I just wonder what made you pick that up.
I like books in translation.
Right.
And I'm really always keen to know what is coming out of Europe. In fact, they are probably my favourite sort of books. Under the radar, what's happening in Europe as against the British or American tradition. I do like that different take,
okay,
which we'll pick up. Getting time to finish. And quickly...
I talked about Anne Cleves, The Sleeping in the Dead, one of her very early books.
Yes.
And Mrs. Jewell and the Wreck of the General Grant as a great piece, I think, of New Zealand historical fiction. And in terms of things I haven't actually read yet, but which I intend to and have great hopes for, Horse by Geraldine Brooks, her first book for 7 years.
Fine. And I gave you a couple of Embedded, Even the Darkest Night, and a quick look at Consolation. That brings us to the end. We look forward to catching up with you in July.
Good night, Gareth.
Yeah.
Good night from him.
Good night from us, or good afternoon.